1 year after the end of America's war in Afghanistan, what can we learn? What must we learn about what happened? And how can long-form storytelling, long-form narrative, help us learn those lessons? Those are a couple of the questions for this week's Reliable Sources podcast. So let's cue the music. I'm Brian Stelter, and this weekly podcast is our chance to go more in-depth, talking with media leaders and newsmakers about the story behind the story. Everyone remembers the story of mid-August 2021, the fall of Kabul, the Taliban's takeover of all of Afghanistan, the chaotic, deadly withdrawal from Kabul by American forces. And of course, as with all the stories every day throughout the news cycle, the Afghanistan story started to fade. And now we hear about the country mostly through brave reporters on the ground, some of whom have had to flee in recent months. Now, with the one-year anniversary, there's a new book that documents the horrors of the Afghanistan withdrawal. It's titled The Fifth Act, America's End in Afghanistan. The author is Elliot Ackerman, a decorated Marine raider, CIA tactical officer, a combat veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan, and also a distinguished novelist. But this is a very real story he's telling in his new book, and he's joining me now. Elliot, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian.
Tell me about bringing a novelist background to this very real, almost unbelievable story that we all witnessed from afar this time last year.
Well, I guess maybe that background plays out in, you know, in the title of the book, you know, The Fifth Act. A year ago, as Afghanistan was collapsing, a friend of mine asked me to write just for her Substack a brief 500-word essay about what was going on. And she said to me, you know, Elliot, because people haven't been paying attention to Afghanistan and they just know that what they're seeing is a tragedy. And it was that word tragedy that struck me because, you know, if you look back from Shakespeare all the way to the ancients, tragedies are typically told in five acts. And the book is structured. The acts are really the presidencies. So you have Bush, Obama, Trump, Biden, and the fifth act is the Taliban. And it's also the story of five distinct evacuation cases that occurred last summer. Mm-hmm. And I want to take the reader, you know, inside of those evacuations, some of which were successful and some that were unsuccessful, and to sort of understand what it looked like and felt like in those days trying to get these Afghans out.
You're writing about something that is still so recent. There's a part of me that just wants to ask a very kind of technical author question, which is, how did you turn this around in 1 year? How were you able to write a, you know, kind of a history of the fall of Kabul and the end of the war in such a quick turnaround?
Well, in early August, just as this was all beginning, before Kabul had even fallen, my editor had the idea of doing just a very short, you know, 30,000 word kind of paperback original just about, you know, what had been going on in Afghanistan for the last few years, because, you know, his point was most Americans have not been paying attention to this and they don't understand it. So we agreed that I would write kind of a shorter book paperback that had some of my, you know, political writings and other things in it just about Afghanistan. Then we both went off to enjoy the last 2 weeks of our summer. And then we saw all of the dramatic events that occurred at the airport. I was intimately involved with many parts of the evacuation. And when that was all done, he and I got on the phone and I said, listen, I just think this is going to be a very different book. Like, yes, it's going to include a lot of that broader context, but it also really needs to be the story of what happened this summer and how the war ended in, you know, the fifth act.
So you mentioned how you were involved this time last year. Tell us a bit about that for context. You were on a family vacation when your phone started lighting up.
Exactly. Well, you know, I was on this long planned family holiday to Italy, of all places. And, you know, my phone had started lighting up a little bit before I left. But those 2 weeks away with my family corresponded with the last 2 weeks of the war. And, you know, my network of you know, friends of mine who are veterans, friends who are still in the service. You know, I've worked for the last 10 years, like you, as a journalist. So all of my friends who are journalists, you know, everyone at that point was trying to get their network of Afghan friends and their families out of the country before the airport closed. And because, you know, the U.S. government didn't really have a plan for this, you know, there was no State Department email address you could refer someone to or website and say, register yourself here and you'll be picked up. Mm. What you saw was really a kind of crowdsourced evacuation as everybody was banding together to try to just do what needed to be done in those days to get people flown to safety.
So then you became part of this virtual evacuation effort. How would you describe it or try to characterize it for people that were only watching this from a distance on television and not feeling it firsthand by being in touch with those who needed help?
You know, well, this was really a first of its kind evacuation effort. You know, a lot had been said before the fall of Kabul that this wasn't going to be a repeat of Saigon. Now, I would say in many ways it was worse than Saigon, only in so much as, you know, it was being felt acutely because all of us are connected. So it was a network of people from, you know, Washington, D.C. to New York to Italy to France to inside of Kabul, all trying to basically patch together the required logistics to get people flown out of the airport. And so, you know, and so what quickly became obvious to me is, you know, everyone was sort of playing their position. So there were people in these networks who were raising money from folks who were trying to bring in charter flights to Kabul airport, people chartering planes. There were journalist colleagues of mine on the ground who were riding in convoys filled with Afghan SIV applicants, special immigrant visa applicants, who were going to help navigate them through Taliban checkpoints. I would say sort of the position I was able to play was just through my own personal network. I knew a whole number of the people at the airport and so was able to, on a few occasions, help get the gates to the airport opened up for groups of Afghans who were trying to get inside.
And that's because in your phone, you have the numbers of generals, of military officials on the ground in Kabul, right?
Well, bro, I'll tell you, it's actually not necessarily the generals who became the most effective. And this is sort of, you know, speaks to the just the times in what we live and how we're all networked together. It turned out early on, I realized that there were two Marine infantry battalions at the airport. And one of them, which actually happened to be my old infantry battalion from the Iraq War, and it was commanded by a roommate, one of my classmates that I'd gone through my training with in Quantico in my early 20s. So we knew each other. And it was, so then it became a matter of figuring out the people you knew at the airport, just so you could say, listen, we have this convoy, they're coming in, can I flag them for you? And that seemed to work because there was just this sort of networked effect of people trying to do what they needed to do in this incredibly chaotic situation.
Right. Your point about Saigon is so interesting because if you were to search transcripts for the cable news coverage this time last year, you'll see hundreds of references to Saigon. That was one of the primary framing devices for the national media, was the comparing it to the fall of Saigon or hoping that it wouldn't be like the fall of Saigon. And your point, Elliot, is it was actually worse because we're so much more connected now. So we were able to see it in almost real time. So the footage of that a plane taking off with people clinging to the sides and falling off, all of these instances were seen almost instantly, as opposed to black and white photos that came later from Vietnam.
Well, it's very human. It's very, I mean, again, it's like it's very tragic in our obsession not to repeat Saigon. Not to repeat that iconic image of the last helicopter going off the roof of the CIA station in Saigon, we actually create, I think, a far more terrible image and grisly image, which is of Afghans clinging to the wheel wells of American cargo planes and then falling to their deaths.
And because so many people in the crowds have phones, we're seeing so much of it. And you, from thousands of miles away, are able to be in touch with people who need help.
Well, and you're getting, and you know, as you know, just being a veteran, because I'm tied into the war, you know, you're getting pulled back into the war because, you know, my phone, I'm getting pinged by people you know, who need help. And they are, you know, sending photos of them and their families. And here's all of our information. Is there anything that you can do? And my experience is by no way unique. I mean, this was the experience of so many veterans I knew. And, you know, and it's this sense of you want to do everything you can do to help, and you're doing your best, but you're also questioning, you know, why is this falling to us? You know, why is our government not able to help process these people or able to make this right? And so I think for a lot of veterans, there was a, you know, an understandable sense of outrage with how this was ending.
And many journalists from CNN and other outlets had similar experiences of becoming rescuers or trying to aid in the rescue, trying to get fixers and drivers and assistants and others out, other Afghans out of the country before the window closed. And you certainly write about that in the book. It's almost kind of these loose alliances, right, of veterans and journalists and NGO organizers and others.
Really, anyone who had been, you know, touched by these 20 years of war. And I think, Brian, you know, the thing that was also really profound and frankly just poignant to me was the recognition of sort of what a relatively small community that is, this community of people who over the past 20 years, almost like we grew up in the war, you know, because I was in my early 20s when all this started and I'm in my early 40s now. And so to see this, again, just this network of, yes, veterans, journalists, humanitarian activists, all kind of united around this one cause, which is just to try to get as many people out as possible during this small last window of time.
And just expand on that a little bit further. In the moment, nobody knew how long the window was, how much longer the window would last in order to be able to extract folks. Now, in retrospect, we know, but we didn't know at the time.
Yeah, well, you knew and you didn't know, right? Because you knew that the president said, you know, all U.S. troops would be out by August 31st, but you didn't know if the airport was going to remain open until August 31st. And I think one of the things that was so, you know, just frankly rending is, you know, I can remember, you know, there were several Afghans, you know, I was in touch with who were way, you know, who had family. I mean, small children they're trying to get out. And the scene at the airport was so chaotic and there was such a crush of people and it's hot that it was dangerous to try to get out of the airport. And so for many of them, you know, were saying, I'm not sure if it's safe for me to go down there. The Taliban were being very brutal at the airport and saying, I'm going to wait a day or two to see just if things get less crazy. But you know that, listen, if you wait a day or two, you're taking on the risk that the airport might not be open in a day or two. And you know, that's a decision you can't make for somebody else, but watching people have to wrestle with that decision, you know, wrestle with the idea of, you know, do I take my wife and my one-year-old and three-year-old children to the airport, to this, you know, mosh pit and try to fight my way through, which is dangerous, you know, or do I wait and see if something better comes along? You know, it's horrible to have to watch people wrestle with those decisions.
Was there any part of you that wanted to be on the ground in Afghanistan as this was unfolding?
Well, you know, by the time events were kind of rolling, there was no practical way to, you know, get to Afghanistan. And I definitely had this palpable sense of, you know, being pulled back into the war psychologically as this just sort of, you know, became a 24-hour a day effort. I mean, you know, we were sleeping, you know, 2 or 3 hours a night for these couple of weeks. You know, that being said, there was a moment during all of this where, you know, Representative Seth Moulton from Massachusetts, he and I are contemporaries from the Marine Corps. We served around the same time, have known each other for many years. And you probably remember he and Representative Meyer from Michigan flew into Kabul. And it was controversial at the time. I very much support Seth's decision to fly in. But I got a phone call from him when he flew in, and I mentioned this in the book. And the call was very brief. He just basically said, I am at Kabul International Airport. You know, if there are people you know who need help, I'm going to be here for a few hours and I might be able to help. And that was our phone call. Mm. But I remember after I got off the phone with him thinking, that's interesting. You know, he was there. Yes, he was a Marine, but he's also a member of the House Armed Services Committee. So he was there in a professional capacity. But I remember thinking, you know, he had the ability to go back. And if I actually had the ability to go into the airport, would I want to go back? And I think, you know, you always feel that draw, particularly in moments of crisis.
I'm just thinking about that juxtaposition you were experiencing from you know, being with the family in Italy versus knowing what was going on there. And it's just a heightened version of what everybody felt in those days.
Well, you know, Brian, I really like, I wanted to put sort of the details of our parts of our family trip in the book, not because I think anybody cares about my family vacation, but because I thought it was important to toggle between those two very different worlds to sort of show the kind of the psychological imbalance of, and I think, you know, I think a number of veterans feel this, you know, your life that you live now as a, you know, father or husband, for me as a writer, which seems a million miles away from the life I used to live as a special operator at war. But in this moment, at the end of the Afghan war, those two are existing in this sort of violent tandem together. And you see that in the book.
Absolutely. More with Elliot Ackerman about the fifth act in just a moment.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back here on the Reliable Sources podcast. I'm Brian Stelter, speaking with Elliot Ackerman about his new book, The Fifth Act, America's End in Afghanistan. So, Elliot, as someone who was on the ground there, was it inevitable that it was going to end this way? Was it inevitable that America would withdraw and it would be chaotic and the country would return to Taliban hands?
Well, I think there's sort of two questions with regards to that inevitability. I think there is the question of, you know, the withdrawal itself and how that withdrawal happened. And when I look and at the decisions that the Biden administration was likely, you know, was making, I think that, you know, what the Biden administration banked on was this idea that there would be a decent interval, you know, a decent interval of being a term that goes back to the Nixon administration and the end of the Vietnam War, when it was the interval from the withdrawal of the last U.S. troops to whenever, you know, the Saigon government collapsed. So in Vietnam, we left in the last U.S. troops left in 1972. Saigon falls in 1975. And in Afghanistan, the Biden administration clearly thought there would be some type of decent interval, that the last American service member would leave. And, you know, the end game in Afghanistan, you know, whether that was the fall of the Ghani government or not, would occur at some future date, maybe 2 years from now, a year from now, or even a few months from now. But that when it happened, we as Americans and the Biden administration wouldn't be holding the bag when the collapse occurred. The moment that you didn't get the decent interval and the collapse occurred while U.S. troops were still in Afghanistan, at that moment, it was a fait accompli that this was going to be a complete catastrophe and really the disaster that we saw. So I think that's the case with regards to the withdrawal. Now, with regards to whether or not the Afghan war, this 20 years of war, had to end in such an unequivocal defeat, I think that's a different question.
When was the last time you were in the country yourself?
2011.
So by then, 2011, I have the impression that the American news media had mostly moved on. And by the way, not just from Afghanistan, but also from the Iraq War at that point, had mostly moved on and returned to domestic stories. Is that your impression as well? Because I'd love to hear your impressions of how the news media did or did not help to educate the public about these ongoing wars.
No, I think that's absolutely the case. I think that the, listen, Brian, you know, every war that America has fought from the revolution to the present day has been fought with like a construct that sustains it in terms of blood and treasure. So, you know, blood being who's going to fight the war, treasure, how are we going to pay for it? You know, for instance, if you look at the American Civil War, the first draft is part of the U.S. Civil War, as is the first ever income tax, which funds the Civil War. The Second World War is characterized by a national mobilization and war bond drives. The Vietnam War is characterized by a very unpopular draft that leads to an anti-war movement that speeds the end of that war. After September 11th, America was going to war again, and we needed a construct to sustain it. The way we sustained the war in terms of blood was with our all-volunteer military, and in terms of treasure was we put the war onto the national credit card. We funded it through our deficit. The last year the United States actually passed a balanced budget was in 2001. So the result of that construct is that the American people have been largely anesthetized to the costs of war. And as such, because the American people don't necessarily feel this unless they are actually, you know, fighting the war or have a loved one in the military, I think it's very natural that the narrative moves away from the war in the media and otherwise. And yes, certainly by 2011, that was the case in Afghanistan, which has long been called the forgotten war. And I'll just say one of the things that was disorienting about last summer was for the first time in years, all of America was again paying attention to Afghanistan.
How did that feel for you? The sudden surge of interest all of a sudden?
I think just disorienting. And sort of, you know, it's, you know, that story, you know, the Afghan war, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Syria, all of this is a story that, you know, I've reported on, written on for years. And to see it kind of back, you know, center stage was interesting, you know, but it was also sort of discouraging at times because you would see, you know, people conflating Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, a number of, you know, there would be a number of people I would see on television saying things like, well, we never should have invaded in the first place. It was on faulty premises. And you're saying, you know, you'd be like, no, that's not, you're thinking of Iraq. You know, Iraq is the WMD war. Afghanistan is the September 11th war. But the fact that it had receded that far from our national consciousness was pretty dispiriting. You know, Brian, can I share a little bit of gallows humor with you?
I would love that.
Okay. Well, there's a knock knock joke that goes around among veterans, and it goes like this. So I'm going to say knock knock. You say who's there?
Go for it.
Okay. So knock knock.
Who's there?
9/11.
9/11 who?
I thought you said you'd never forget.
I walked right into that one.
Right? But you know, I think that's just sort of, you know, the fact that that joke, you know, has made the round for years in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, just sort of, I think, speaks to this sense that America had walked away from the wars.
And then every so often, as with the killing of al-Zawahiri, just a number of weeks ago, there's this, again, a burst of attention, a burst of interest. I thought it was so telling on the day that Biden spoke and announced the drone strike that, you know, commentators on Fox and elsewhere were saying, yeah, we don't really cover the war on terror anymore. It's not really front of mind anymore. But there is still this ongoing U.S. effort to capture and kill terror leaders. And here's al-Zawahiri being killed. But did you notice what I noticed, which is that story lasted like 6 hours? You know, like, yeah. By the next day, it was as if it had never happened in terms of the news cycle.
I think that's certainly the case. I mean, listen, you know, but like these aren't necessarily new things, right? I mean, we are as Americans famously equipped with very short attention spans, And the geography of our country has often, you know, insulated us from the world's problems. So yes, it can be dispiriting, you know, to see that. It's also, I think, a little dispiriting because, you know, killing terrorists is not a strategy. It's a tactic. Like, America's always, we've been good at 20 years. We figured out how to kill terrorists. The problem we've had in the war on terror is that we haven't had the strategic successes that we need along the way. And I think that's still the position that we're in. But yes, we have a very short attention span as Americans. And, you know, unless the barbarians are truly at the gates, we have a hard time fixating on these stories and sort of prefer to, you know, for lack of a better term, navel gaze on our domestic quibbles.
Speaking of the gates, I remember so vividly that Sunday morning, August 15th, when Kabul officially fell, when the Taliban officially entered the capital. And I felt a lot of pressure on air to try to describe it in the scope, you know, to meet the moment, right? To describe right. The size of what we were experiencing, the collapse of the Afghan government, the end of American nation building dreams, right? And most importantly, the beginning of this frightening new era for Afghan civilians. And that's what you've done with the Fifth Act. You've made sure that they're, you know, the experiences of these ordinary Afghan men and women are recognized, some of whom because they worked and helped the U.S. government. But, you know, I'm thinking about the journalists now who are trying to tell Afghanistan's story and how it's becoming increasingly harder and harder to do so. So is it fair to say that the window we have, the view we have into Afghanistan is shrinking? Is that the right way to think about it?
Well, I think these things go in cycles, Brian. You know, I certainly think that, you know, as much as America might be done with Afghanistan, Afghanistan is certainly not done with America. And our national narratives are to a certain degree entwined. So I don't know what the next chapter is. Vis-a-vis the Afghan-American relationship. But I feel very certain that there is a next chapter. And I think it's also worth bearing in mind how Afghanistan links to other, you know, global events and global stories that have really shaped the month since the fall of Kabul. I mean, like, what a remarkable six-month period, you know, August to, I guess, what? You know, February or March of this past year, in which in August, you see probably one of NATO's darkest hours in this just debacle of a withdrawal from Kabul International Airport. And then about 6 months later, we see one of NATO's, you know, brightest hours as, you know, the alliance overperforms when Russia invades Ukraine. And, you know, we've seen recently the addition of Finland and Sweden into the alliance. And, you know, those are certainly connected events, because I assure you that as Putin was weighing last summer whether or not to invade Ukraine, you know, he turned on his TV and could see the images that were coming out of Kabul. And those images, I mean, they, I'm not saying that they're what made him invade Ukraine, but they certainly didn't deter him from invading Ukraine when he was trying to consider what the NATO response would be. It seemed as though the NATO response would be pretty feckless if you watched how the alliance performed in Afghanistan.
And I should mention your most recent article for The Atlantic is all about that, about the rivalry that defines America, about Russia's dealing with the U.S. and Ukraine. People can find it at theatlantic.com. When it comes to the Fifth Act and America's end in Afghanistan, I know there's a lot of people that want to look the other way, who don't want to think anymore about that war, about the end of the war, but about that war at all. Why should they read your book? Why should they buy your book, Elliot?
Well, I mean, ultimately, listen, this isn't a book that's about politics in so much as it's a book about, you know, the people who were wrapped up in this war. It's about the Afghans who were trying to leave. I mean, some of the most remarkable acts of courage I've seen in 20 years of war, I saw last summer, and they were performed by everyday civilians who were doing whatever it took for them to get their family, their children out of that country so they could have a better life. And at the end of the day, you know, those are just human stories. You know, and it, I don't know, it speaks to kind of just our general humanity. So I think you don't have to have really an interest in the war to want to have an interest in these types of harrowing stories. So I hope people pick it up and take something away from it.
And will you be back to writing novels in the future? I suspect it's probably less painful to write fiction than it is to write this kind of nonfiction.
Well, you know, I've always prided myself on working in both realms as a novelist and as a journalist. But I do. I have a novel that will be out next spring. It is not about war or
any of this. You use all the muscles. That makes sense.
Yeah, got to.
Elliot Ackerman, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
And that's a wrap on this week's Reliable Sources podcast. We will see you on television this Sunday, every Sunday, 11 a.m. Eastern Time on CNN. And make sure you're on the list for our nightly newsletter as well, reliablesources.com. Sign up for free, get on the list, and we'll hear you back this time next week. Thanks for tuning in.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.